the most influential bloggers on the internet. But in 2006, he was struggling. Back of his mind, he knew he was destined to make some kind of noise, and he was ready to crank up the volume. He had his hand in on any number of deals, including his own startup. He was also a guest lecturer teaching a course on effective career strategies. It was a sideline pursuit, but in his lectures were the seeds of the 4-hour work week concept, seeds that were destined to grow and grow. Trouble was, Tim couldn't figure out how to plant those suckers. People heard me speak, heard what I was doing, and they kept telling me I should write a book. He shares when we sat down to discuss the theme of this book. It was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard. I couldn't write. Couldn't think of how to begin. I didn't want to write anything longer than an email. But then the class started to take on a new shape. The notes started to come together, and I had all these ideas about lifestyle design and breaking free of all the outdated assumptions that were coloring our working lives. I started to see there might be an opportunity here. It took a while for him to chase it down, though. And in the chasing, without even thinking about it, Tim harnessed the power of broke and put it to work for him. Just by treating people with the courtesy and curiosity that came naturally to him. His book was a mega, mega smash, but it came together in a back against the wall kind of way. Initially, it took reaching out to a contact he made a couple years earlier. After Tim had just moved to Silicon Valley to work on his internet startup, an online nutritional supplements company. I didn't know anyone, Tim recalls. Didn't have any money, was driving my mom's hand-me-down minivan. It was horrible. Like a lot of entrepreneurs and outside-the-box thinkers, Tim had a restless energy and a boundless enthusiasm for new people, new ideas. Yeah, he was busting his ass on his startup, but he was also hedging his bets, working a lot of different angles. He still made time to volunteer for a local nonprofit that staged some big-time promotions. He believed the one fed the other, so he found the time, and he busted his ass as a volunteer as well. He kept taking on more responsibility, showing more initiative, and it got to where he was asked to attend one of the organization's board meetings and take on a lead role in an upcoming event. One of his jobs was to put together a panel of A-list speakers, so he reached out to a group of folks he really, really wanted to meet. The guy who created the Pet Rock, the guy behind the 100 million selling Chicken Soup for the Soul publishing franchise, the co-founder of Electronic Arts, the man behind the Cliff Bar, and on and on. I had no money, no connections, no way to meet these people and figure out how they got to where they were, he tells me. Those kind of connections, they're invaluable. The chance to talk to these people, to learn something from them, even just to breathe the same air, is huge. But on my own, there was no way I could get them to sit down and talk to me. The only thing I had to offer was time and an invitation to a pretty cool event that promised a ton of media coverage. So I made an investment. I'd spend all my time on this, take full advantage of the organization's name, the access it was giving me, and make things happen. Tim wanted to organize a killer event, set up a killer panel of speakers, but he also wanted to meet these good people and soak up what he could from them. I totally get that. I was the same way when I was just starting out, hungry for inside insights, eager to soak up what I could from folks who knew their stuff, whatever that stuff happened to be. Walk that two-way street. Tim's a smart guy. He could see that on his own, he had nothing to trade on other than his keen interest and enthusiasm. That's how it goes in most mentor-mentee relationships. Well, you're on the way up. It's all about what you need, what you want out of the deal. But my thing is, it's got to be a two-way street. I tell young people all the time, when they're reaching out for advice, guidance, whatever, that in order for me to help them, to be available to them, to take them under my wing, I've got to sleep less, or maybe take myself away from something else I need to be doing. There are only so many hours in a day, right? In the story of Mosiah Bridges that I just shared, what was in it for me was personal. He came on the Shark Tank set like a little mini-me, and it was so clear to me that he and his mom were onto something that could be life-changing for them, life-affirming even. It felt to me like I had no choice but to help him power up his bow-tie business. But that's not how it usually goes. No, usually, there's a cost to me when I mentor someone, and it's on the prospective mentee to recognize this cost in the transaction. That doesn't mean I'm not happy to help, just that there's gotta be something in it for me as well. Usually, the takeaway comes in the chance to see how these young people think, how they interact with the product, and how they move about in the marketplace. But you've got to give to get, man. It's how business gets done, and Tim recognized this early on. He knew, for example, that if he abused this up-close relationship with Jack Canfield, the Chicken Soup publisher, it wouldn't serve him in the long run. So he made an effort to nurture this connection over the years without really asking for anything in return. I never asked Jack to mentor me, Tim said, even though I could have benefited from his advice, but from time to time I'd reach back out to him with a question or comment. You know, whatever I could think to keep the conversation going, as long as he didn't come away thinking I had my hand out. This went on for years, until finally I mentioned that I was thinking of doing a book. And at that point, Jack was all over it and introduced me to an agent. He wanted to help. It's like I didn't even have to ask. We'd hit it off on that first pass, and he seen that I wasn't just out for myself, so he went out of his way for me. The story doesn't end there, of course. Publishers kept turning Tim down, and some of the rejections were just about violent. Sure, there were a couple of polite turndowns, but for the most part, publishers had an intensely negative reaction to Tim's pitch. The worst of these tended to focus on Tim's age, with comments like, "Who is this kid to tell me I'm working too hard?" Or, "How old is this author again, and he knows the secret to creating work-life balance?"
Power fact. Before publishing his first book, Stephen King was ready to give up on his entire writing career. After getting 30 rejections, he threw his first novel in the trash, but his wife retrieved it and urged him to keep going. He has since gone on to sell over 350 million copies of his books. Most of them have been made into major motion pictures. Now, it's tough to believe in yourself when the rest of the world kind of like lines up against you. So be sure to have someone on your side to help you see things a little more clearly. Now, mentors are great, but sometimes a cheerleader is even better. And as far as strategic partners are concerned, sometimes you find your best support at home.
The response was mystifying, frustrating, soul-sucking, but Tim kept at it. I think that's one of the reasons I was drawn to him, and him to me. He was turned down by 27 publishers. I'd been turned down by 27 banks when I was out looking to finance our first FUBU orders. 27 rejections. And yet neither one of us was willing to take no for an answer. So we kept pounding on doors. Tim had a respected literary agent to help with the pounding, a superstar editor who recently switched to the agency side of the business and was determined to do right by his first clients. So that helped, obviously. But in the end, all the agent can do was get Tim to the door. It was up to Tim to power his way through.
Power fact. Walt Disney was turned down 302 times before getting financing for Walt Disney World. Today, the resort attracts over 25 million visitors each year. Now, a stat like that tells you two things. One, there are a whole lot of people and institutions you can hit up for a loan. And two, when those people and institutions hit back, you've got to hang in there. Believe in yourself, believe in your business, believe in your dream, and the money will come. Maybe not right away, but soon enough.
That kind of determination, it comes from a place of nothing to lose. It comes from throwing all of your heart, all of your energy into this one big project. It's your one big opportunity, so you give it your all. Finally, after that 27th rejection, Tim was down to his last shot. A meeting in New York with a team from Crown Publishing, a division of Random House. Full disclosure, Crown happens to be my publisher as well. Going in, Tim knew he had to crush this meeting in order to get a deal. So he figured he'd just go for it. Put himself out there. Do his thing in a big time way. At the head of the table sat the guy with the power to say yes or no. So Tim focused in on him. Always a good strategy in a make-or-break moment. It was one of those Death Star meetings, Tim remembers. The way they do it at a lot of the big media companies, They bring in like 30 people from marketing, sales, publicity. Everybody sits around a giant conference table. There was no way I could remember everyone's name or what their role was in the company, so I kept trying to steer things back to the main guy at the head of the table. The room would go on his gut, so that's where I put my focus. Seize the day. That meeting with the publisher went well enough, and when it was about to wrap, Tim made his final pitch. He truly believed that the ideas he'd been discussing in his classes could transform the ways we live and work. And by telling these folks at Crown that he was prepared to fight like crazy to make this book a hit, to make sure his message resonated with the widest possible audience, they could move forward knowing they weren't just buying a book, they were buying a brand with a pit bull type marketing machine behind it. You have to realize this whole thing went down just before Christmas 2006, prehistoric times in terms of social media. Facebook was still in its infancy, just kind of creeping around from college campuses into the mainstream, and Twitter was only a couple of months old. Tim took a look at the internet landscape and realized he'd have to find a way to make some electronic noise to call attention to his book, because Crown wasn't about to throw a whole lot of money at promotion, especially now that he'd all but told them he'd generate a ton of publicity on his own. The way it works in the book business, like in other businesses, is that the publishers tend to put money behind books they've already put money into, and they hadn't really sunk any money into the 4-hour work week. So Tim was on his own here. I realized that online was really the only sandbox I could play in, Tim tells me. Everyone was talking about bloggers, so I thought, that could be interesting. Who are these blogger people? I should probably figure all of that out. So I did. And it's embarrassing to admit, but I went online. The day after Christmas, I started reading all these different blogs, and I just tried to soak in as much as I could. You know, see where I could fit myself into that conversation. Follow your gut, follow your nose. It turned out Tim's research took him to the Consumer Electronics Show, CES, in Las Vegas, where he learned he could find a group of bloggers all in one place. It turned out, too, that the first job he had out of college was selling mass data storage systems. So he knew the landscape a little bit, knew the language. He realized that if he wanted to connect with bloggers, maybe find a way to get them excited about his work-life concept, the easiest way to do that would be to reach out to them in person, to as many of them as possible, all at once. He figured any successful blogger was already getting a ton of email, so there was no way his message would stand out in a crowded inbox, and he could just forget about contacting them by phone. So he had to find a way to put himself in the same room with them and make his pitch face-to-face, one by one. The Consumer Electronics Show, that was his answer. Once in Vegas, Tim did some more investigating, more networking, and was able to talk himself into a convention lounge called the Blog House, where there was free booze and free Wi-Fi for bloggers. Basically, a good place to see and be seen. He skulked around for a bit, looking for a way in, and ended up at the check-in table, making small talk with the woman who was handing out wristbands to the bloggers who had been invited to the event. Without an invite, Tim could only hope to snake past this checkpoint, or he could turn on the charm and see where that got him. That's always been a key for me, he says, being nice. If you're nice to people, if you go out of your way to be helpful, then good things tend to happen. So Tim kind of lurked around the check-in table, and whenever he saw the woman was free, he would tell her a bit of his story, tell her this was his first time at the convention, tell her he didn't really know anybody, didn't really know how things worked. He would have offered to buy the woman a drink, but the drinks were free. So instead, he offered to make a drink run for everyone at the table. He did this a couple times, and in between bartending trips, he sat and listened, soaked up what he could, offered to help where he could, just generally tried to be nice and make himself useful. Make your moment happen. One of Tim's goals for the day was to meet an influential blogger named Robert Scoble. He was like the guy at the CES conference, as far as Tim was concerned. And Tim wasn't the only one who wanted to get to him. There was a scrum of people trying to get Scoble's attention. This presented a problem. Tim didn't want to be just a face in the crowd if he got a chance to talk to Scoble. He didn't want to have to scream or wave or tug on his shirt to get him to talk to him. That's no way to start a meaningful conversation. But every time Tim saw a potential opening, another scrum of people would materialize at this guy's feet, like he was a rock star. At some point, Tim mentioned his frustrations to his new friends at the check-in table, specifically to the woman who seemed to be in charge. Her name was Miriam, and she just happened to be married to Robert Scoble. She said, "No problem, I'll introduce you." "That's how being nice can pay off," he explains. Of course, he had no way of knowing, going in, that Miriam was married to Scoble. But because he moved about that convention lounge like he wanted to earn his keep, because he made no bones about being a little out of his element, because he wasn't shy about asking for help and guidance, because he'd gone out of his way to be helpful and to make sure he didn't come across as a pain in the ass, this one piece of good karma came his way. His positive energy brought back a positive result. Sure enough, he got some time with Scoble later that day, and Scoble found enough to like in Tim's concept to write about it in his blog. And Tim credits that one small mention with getting the ball rolling. The book still hadn't come out, but now there was this buzz attached to it. And from there, he managed to beg, borrow, and sweet talk an invitation to South by Southwest, another influential conference and multimedia music festival, this one held annually in Austin, Texas. Here it was, the same story all over again. Tim didn't have a real presence at the conference. He had no idea what he was doing there, really. But he knew enough to connect with Hugh Forrest, who runs the show down there. Tim introduced himself, told Hugh Forrest about his book, told him about the buzz it was generating, told him he'd love to land some kind of speaking slot at the conference. Tim had no idea what to expect when he flew to Austin, hadn't even thought to book a room in advance. And since the hotels in the city were all sold out, he ended up crashing at a friend's place. Whenever possible, wherever he saw an opening, he pressed his case to Hugh Forrest. He was treading that line between being persistent and being a pest, between ingratiating and irritating. And on about a third or fourth pass, something amazing happened. There was a sudden opening in the conference schedule. One of the speakers had to drop out at the last minute, and Hugh Forrest needed someone to fill the slot. Timing is everything, right? So there was Tim Ferriss, in exactly the right place at exactly the right time, happy to step in. He had a day to prepare. Not a whole lot of time, really, but this dude knew his stuff. He'd be speaking in one of the sponsored rooms, away from the main stage, which meant people would be eating and drinking and milling about. Not exactly the ideal gig, but he was happy for it just the same. Make noise where you can, when you can. "I tear up when I think back on that moment," Tim says when he walks me through what happened next. "I was really nervous about my presentation, and the friend I was staying with, he had three chihuahuas, great dogs, all three of them, each a different size, each with a different personality. So I was kind of pacing around my friend's house, and when I went out into the garage and the three dogs all followed, I guess because they thought I was going to get food. And as I turned around and saw them sitting there looking at me expectantly, I thought, what the hell? So I went right into my pitch, right there in front of these three chihuahuas. I knew they couldn't understand a word I was saying, of course, but I also knew they could tell by my energy, by my body language, if what I was saying was interesting, important. Sounds crazy, I know, but I told myself that if I wasn't engaging, the dogs would just wander off. If I could keep them interested, then I would be okay. Somehow, my boy Tim held the dog's attention. He went all Tony Robbins on them, he says. And if anyone had been looking on, they would have thought he'd gone completely Looney Tunes. But out of that weird moment in his friend's garage, doing his thing in front of those three dogs, he found his way. Here it would be great to be able to write that Tim went out the next day and nailed his presentation. But it didn't exactly go down that way. The tech support failed on him. He had a whole PowerPoint-type thing set up with his laptop. But the Wi-Fi went dead, and the sound was all messed up, and he had to scramble. But he knew his material cold by this point. He'd rehearsed it so much, top to bottom, even played it to an audience of dogs. Talk about a tough room. So he did okay. Better than okay, actually. However it came about, that South by Southwest conference was where he made his bones. Robert Scoble might have put him on the map, but it was the next push from Hugh Forrest that made people start to think that spot on the map was a place they had to visit. Turn each opportunity into the next opportunity. Out of all that, good things started to happen. And the great lesson here is that Tim put himself in a position to succeed. Over and over again, he found ways to position himself for a strong selling opportunity. Yeah, it helped that he had a kick-ass concept that he'd field-tested in his classroom and fine-tuned as he set it all down on paper. But it also helped that he put himself out into the world, looking for a way to make some noise for his book. It helped that he went out of his way to be nice to people, and that he was honest enough in his dealings with the movers and shakers he was trying to reach, that he didn't try to pass himself off as something he was not. He was genuine, and people responded to that. He believed in himself, and he believed in his message, and people responded to that too. And here's another thing. One of the biggest assists Tim got in his pre-publication push came from Robert Scoble's wife, Miriam. This didn't come about in a scheming way. It was real. It was serendipitous. But it was all important. Without that connection to this woman at the CES show in Vegas, he might have been dead in the water. With it, he was on his way. A lot of times, with the Shark Tank pitch or another business idea I'm pursuing, the real test comes about in a behind-the-scene kind of way. I'll call my go-to guys and try to drum up financing, but it can take a gentle nudge from someone completely outside the transaction to seal the deal. Here's what I mean. Let's say one of my guys is in bed, watching television with his wife, eating potato chips or ice cream or whatever, and there's a spot featuring a product my guy is considering. If his wife leans over to him and says, "Oh my God, I would totally use that," well, it's a done deal. Think about it. Our most trusted advisors are the people closest to us. They might not know our business, but they give it to us straight. And here, it worked out that Tim Ferriss had just happened to make a connection with the wife of an influential blogger, uniquely positioned to shine some light on his upcoming book. If Tim had been pushy or arrogant or full of himself, she wouldn't have offered to introduce him. But because he was nice, because he was transparent and forthcoming and helpful, she went out of her way for him. Jack Canfield, the Chicken Soup publisher, went out of his way for Tim, too, because Tim didn't try to trade on their friendship. And Hugh Forrest at South by Southwest ended up needing something from Tim, the same way Tim needed something from Hugh, and it worked out that they could fit their needs together in a mutually beneficial way. I'll leave it to Tim to tell the rest of the story behind his amazing book. A book that was on the New York Times bestseller list for nearly 5 years. But know this, even with all that runaway success, he's still out there hustling and scraping. "That's the great Wayne Gretzky line," he explains, "about skating to where the puck is going, not where it is. That's been my approach. I want to be able to anticipate all these different trends, anticipate all these changes in the marketplace. And sometimes that means you have to take some risks. You take a lot of arrows, but if there's a wave no one's surfed before, that's the wave I want to be on."
Tim's key shark point: adore what you do. All along, the 4-hour workweek concept was close to Tim's heart. He practiced it, preached it, loved it. Mostly, he loved the way it could transform lives once people bought into it. This became his passion, his fuel. Only, the irony of making that happen for others could have been easily lost on a hard charger like Tim. He was too busy working his tail off and loving every minute of it to realize that his 4-hour workweek concept was only connecting with so many people because he was putting in 100-hour workweeks himself. Here again, we see a great example of a successful entrepreneur who started out with a message, a mission, and out of that, he was able to build a business and a brand. So what are you trying to get across?
Be funny. This is where I need to be. Josh Peck, actor, comedian, social media influencer. If you grew up at a certain time in a certain way, you know the Nickelodeon tween sitcom Drake and Josh, which came out in 2004. For a lot of millennials, this was one of those defining shows that stamped their childhoods. And now one of the show's stars, Josh Peck, is continuing to influence their young adulthoods, but in a whole new way. Josh has continued to act in these years since Drake and Josh ended. He's been in movies like The Wedding Ringer and Red Dawn and The Wackness, guest starred on hit television shows like The Big Bang Theory and The Mindy Project. Probably his best-known post-Nickelodeon gig has been the voice of Eddie in those great Ice Age animated movies. He's also been kicking it as a stand-up comedian. If you've never seen him perform, you should check him out. This is one funny dude. A lot of actors have a hard time transitioning from childhood stardom to adult roles. And here, Josh has been blessed with a second act in his career. He might not be cranking at the same level as he was as a kid, but he's working a lot. But that's not the reason I wanted to talk to Josh for this book. I sought him out for the work he's doing in social media, where he's become a phenomenally successful influencer with millions of followers on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Vine, and YouTube. This alone is not so unusual. There are dozens of important tastemakers and opinion setters helping to shape public opinion and shine a light on the shifts and trends that define our popular culture. Actually, dozens seem like a lowball estimate. There are probably hundreds of people who fill this role in a meaningful way, maybe even thousands. No, what's interesting to me about Josh, and the reason he needs to be a part of this conversation, is how he's done such a swift 180 in his acting career and found a way to build on his fame that doesn't leave him at the mercy of casting directors and producers who may or may not want to hire him for this or that role. It's easy to look on and think this transformation came about on its own, a happy accident of the information age. But that's not the case. As we'll see, Josh set out to adapt his television personality to an entirely new medium as a way to take control of his life and career. And he did it in a way that was completely genuine and a great example of the power of broke. "I grew up as a pretty chubby kid," Josh says. "My sense of humor came out of that. I didn't want to be the sad, chubby guy, so comedy was like my defense mechanism. I figured if I could make you laugh first, you wouldn't be inclined to maybe poke fun or for me to be the butt of the joke." His comedy is at the heart of his social media presence. He regularly posts short, funny videos that seem to share the silly Nickelodeon-type sensibility that made him famous, but in an adult, turbocharged way. He's no longer the chubby kid out to deflect any negative attention. These days, Josh is a toned, slimmed-down poster boy for healthy living. You could barely recognize him from his Drake and Josh days, and yet his loyal fans have followed him from the small screen to the even smaller screens in their pockets. And they just don't follow him. They're devoted to him, sharing his posts and tweets and videos in a kind of viral way that can't help but catch the attention of major advertisers. One of the reasons I sparked to Josh's story was because, like many of the stories you've read about in these pages, it reminded me so much of my own. An only child raised in New York City by a single mom. He didn't always have it easy. There weren't a lot of positive male role models in his life, so he got himself a big brother through the Big Brother Big Sister Foundation, and he's still close to that person today. That's a great reminder that even influencers need influences. His mom worked out of the apartment as a career coach, so the income wasn't always steady. "There were tough times," Josh says now. "Some months were better than others, but mostly we were doing okay." Find your first big break. Josh's power of broke story has more to do with his passion for performing than it does with the lack of resources. Starting out, there was money for headshots and lessons and all the stuff that goes along with pursuing a show business career. Not a lot of money, but just enough. Also, Josh was surrounded by supportive, talented mentors from the moment he decided he wanted to pursue an acting career. He went to school at the Professional Performing Arts School, so the idea of acting was in the air and all around. There were mentors and coaches and role models up and down the hallways of that school. There was a clear path to follow. His mom's schedule was flexible enough that she was able to take him on auditions around town. "Those were real cattle calls," he remembers. "You look around the room, and there's literally 200 kids who look just like you. and everybody's trying to get the gig, selling Oreos or whatever it was. And my mom would sit there for hours, trying to be supportive, but after a while, she'd want to just get out of there. She was so over it, but for some reason, I had this drive. I said, no, this is where I need to be. Trouble is, in the acting business, your success is tied to the whims of others, basically, to forces beyond your control. Even our most successful performers talk about their first big break, and how so many things had to fall in just the right way for them to land their breakout role. So, for a while in there, Josh was riding high. But as Drake and Josh ran his course, he was finding it tougher and tougher to get his next gig. That clear path he set out on when he was just starting out, it was no longer taking him where he wanted to go. But instead of throwing up his hands in frustration, Josh grabbed his cell phone and turned on the camera. He was a performer at heart, so he worked the room in whatever way he could. Without even thinking about it, Josh started making these short, quirky videos, mostly to amuse himself and keep busy. His videos made him laugh, then they made his friends and family members laugh, and soon they were making a lot of people laugh, people Josh didn't even know. He had a small base of Twitter followers from his Nickelodeon days, so there was a ready group of fans who had access to these videos once he posted them on Vine, and before he knew it, he was getting an enormous number of hits, likes, retweets, whatever. He tapped into something way bigger than anything he'd ever experienced on television. Not because the raw numbers were bigger, necessarily, but there was a deeper, more personal connection. This wasn't a business maneuver, Josh explains. This wasn't a strategy or anything I thought through. This was just me trying to find new ways to express myself. This was me putting my energy into something new. Because it's easier to have a dream when you're a kid, when you're a teenager. Back then, it doesn't cost you anything to follow your dreams. But then you get a little older and life takes hold. All of a sudden, you have bills and responsibilities, and it's easy to say, okay, let me make a little money first, and I can worry about the dreams later. And then, inevitably, that voice gets softer and softer until it almost disappears. Survey the scene. The way it worked out for Josh the actor was that the voice started to fade around the time Josh the social media magnate was emerging. He had a couple of friends who encouraged him to bolster his online presence in a systematic way. One, a school friend who went on to work in social media. The other, his big brother, who'd become a savvy business person. Josh studied how others had grown their platforms to where they could turn them into viable, sustainable engines of promotion, grow them into something even bigger than he could ever imagined. He started hearing from big companies like McDonald's and Citibank, which saw a way to tap into the young adult market by aligning Josh with their products and services. And soon, there was an income stream coming in on the back of all those loopy videos. That stream went from a trickle to a torrent in just a couple of years. The biggest key was consistency, Josh reflects on his social media rollout. People get accustomed to seeing something on a daily basis or some kind of regular basis. They know that at a certain time each day, a certain time each week, they could find a new video from me. Maybe something that would take them out of their routines for just a few minutes. Maybe make them smile. They know there'll be some cool new trend being talked about by this person or a stunning photo posted by that person. It becomes like clockwork, and people start to know they can rely on you. That's the way to build a devoted following. You have to deliver, and you have to keep delivering. When you listen to Josh talk about how he found his way online, he sounds like he's got a doctorate in social media. But that wasn't always the case. The dude did a lot of research, spent a lot of time figuring out the lay of the land, and that bumps right into one of my key shark points, H, for do your homework. You have to become a student of the game, he explains. Study what you're passionate about. See what other people are doing. Learn what works. Learn what doesn't work. And then figure out how you can improve on that. Do things slightly differently. Make it true to your own voice. This right here is one of the keys to Josh's online persona. It feels completely natural, unforced. And that's because it is completely natural, unforced. Take a look at Josh's Twitter feed or his Vine, and you'll see what I mean. If you follow him, it's probably because you get the same sense like you're being invited along his giant roller coaster of a party. He's fun and funny and sometimes downright silly. And occasionally he sprinkles in a product endorsement. If it's something he believes in, if it's consistent with his personality, he's definitely true to his own voice. So much so that his millions of followers are never made to feel like they're being sold. His business doesn't feel like a business, and that's one of the key reasons he's been so successful. Here's Josh's work-life advice to young people looking to make some noise in their own fields in their own way. I would say be in the efforts business, not the results business. It's hard to know exactly how things are going to turn out when you put something into the ether. You hope that people like it, have some kind of positive reaction to it, maybe want to share it with their friends. And that reaction can be immediate or it could come over time. You just never know. So the point really is to take that first step. Put something out there. Put yourself out there. Because really, there's nothing new here. Advertising and promotion, these are not new concepts. What's new is that companies are figuring out that there are all these great new ways to reach their customers and to have that interaction be more natural, more personal. He's right, you know. There is nothing new under the sun. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Even a transforming social media platform like Twitter isn't such a radically new idea. Like I wrote back in the day, Twitter was a note strapped to the leg of a homing pigeon. It's just a new form of delivery. So the game comes in how to figure out all these new variations on these old ideas and to find a way to get out in front of them. And right now, my friend Josh Peck has got it figured out just about as well as anyone.
Josh's key shark point. Adore what you do. Look back at Josh's impact in social media and what do you see? Well, you see a young performer who loves to make people laugh, loves to be in the spotlight, but he loves to call his own shots. It comes down to passion. Josh is a performer at heart, but when you're an actor, you find yourself working at the whims of others. You might be really good at your craft, but unless you're writing, producing, and directing your own materials, you still have to go after each gig with your hand out. Josh kind of stumbled into a way to eliminate that part of the hustle. He started making these short videos as a way to keep his creative juices flowing, and never once thinking that it would turn into anything other than a way to amuse himself and maybe make a couple of people smile. That's the key reason they took off the way they did. Because he didn't have his hand out. Because he was genuine. And because his enthusiasm was all over the damn place. He was just out there having a good old time and folks couldn't help but pick up on that. What makes you happy? What are you passionate about? Figure it out and embrace it. Once you make joy your biggest asset, you're way ahead of the game.
5. Broke isn't just personal. There was a great moment during the 2012 presidential campaign when Mitt Romney famously said, "Corporations are people, my friend." He caught a lot of flack for that comment, remember? But he said it in the context of a 2010 Supreme Court decision that found that businesses have the rights to religious freedoms and other forms of personal expression, same as you and me. Still, it sounded a little weird. A little out there to hear all these politicians and lawmakers talking about corporations in human terms. And yet I'm about to do the same thing here. Kind of. Sort of. See, when I'm on the road doing my thing, speaking to people about the benefits of staying lean and hungry in business, I'm always quick to point out that our power of broke mindset can be applied to companies as well as to individuals. Even corporations with huge budgets can keep thriving if they find a way to honor their homespun roots and stick to the same principles and strategies that drove their initial growth. In other words, if they had to scrape and scramble when they were just starting out, they should continue to scrape and scramble, continue to act hungry, even if they now have the resources to throw a bunch of money at a problem.
Power fact. 62% of Fortune 500 companies maintain an active Twitter account. Well, listen, with a stat like that, I can only shake my head and wonder, what are the other 38% thinking?
Case in point, a while back I was invited to speak at General Mills. The guy who arranged for my visit wanted me to talk to his brand managers, who kept telling him they couldn't launch this or that product with just a $20 million or $30 million marketing budget. This was frustrating, he said, because General Mills was well known in the cereal and snack food industry for its gorilla-type relaunch of its top-selling line of granola bars, Nature Valley. These days, Nature Valley is one of the top-performing brands at General Mills. In 2014, the product line made the largest contribution to the company's growth in its absolute terms, across all categories. The story behind Nature Valley, my General Mills contact told me, was that it used to be an underperforming brand. It was started in 1975, but it never really took off. We couldn't give the thing away, he said. You'll see this type of thing at a lot of companies. There'll be a drag on the bottom line the bigwigs just can't shake for trying. But that doesn't mean you stop trying. So the company assigned the product line to a young brand manager, gave him a small budget, and told him to do the best he could with it. And that's exactly what that young guy did. Get out there. Instead of going the traditional route to boost Nature Valley sales, buying up expensive commercial time on television, hustling for shelf space and promotional placement in supermarkets, taking out ads in major national magazines, the brand manager took an off-the-beaten-path approach. Literally. Remember, this was way before the explosion in social media, well before the time when our biggest companies regularly promote their products and services on Facebook, Twitter, etc., at little to no cost. He reached out to ski resorts, outdoor adventure centers, and other places where active, health-minded young people and families tended to congregate. He plastered the lodges and common areas of these resorts with posters and signs featuring the Nature Valley logo, and then he gave away a whole bunch of granola bars, as many as these hungry outdoor enthusiasts could grab. He also handed out stickers and encouraged folks to find places to display them, although I'm afraid this tactic might have backfired on the resort owners, because soon there were stickers plastered all over the chairlifts, the locker room areas, the parking lot signs. Still, it turned out to be a genius move, and it cost next to nothing. Just the cost of the goods, basically. Despite the sticker graffiti, the resort operators were happy to have the brand representatives on site because they were able to offer this free benefit to their guests. So it was a win-win all around, and most agreed to stage Nature Valley giveaway promotions again and again. After a couple seasons targeting this narrow, affluent market, the product line began to show some serious signs of life. For a public company like General Mills, with over 43,000 employees, to be agile enough to embark on this kind of ground-up campaign, it basically means that no company is too big to think small. It puts me in the mind of a concept I covered in my second book, The Brand Within, where I talked about the four stages of product evolution. I'm reinforcing it here because it ties into our discussion about growth. Point is, our biggest global brands don't just become global brands. After all, there are no overnight successes in businesses. At least, there are no sustainable overnight successes.
Power fact. Coca-Cola sold just 25 bottles in its first year of operation. It helps to know that even the big boys and girls start out small. Now, well, go ahead. I want you to dream big, but keep it real coming out of the gate. And know that your proof of concept can be found in just 25 bottles of soda, as long as you keep moving the sales needle.
No, brands emerge over time, and they must pass through four different stages before they become huge, ubiquitous, unstoppable. You can apply these same stages to every entrepreneur as well. And what I've learned in studying the pop culture marketplace is that most times you have to get past each stage in order to reach the next one. 1. Item. 2. Label. 3. Brand. 4. Lifestyle. An item is just that. An item. It's plain, basic, no frills, with nothing to distinguish it. Think of a plain brown tote bag with no markings on it. A plastic bowl with no special Tupperware type features. A paperweight. It is what it is, and it does what it does. And if you misplace it, you'll find it so readily available, you can replace it with no effort at all. It fills a need. That's all. A label has got a little more to it. Maybe it's a flannel shirt you pick up on the sale rack at Walmart, or a cheap pocket calculator you find at Rite Aid. There's a name on the product, but it's not a name you know. It's not a name you reach for. And even if you're happy with the purchase, it's not a name you'll necessarily remember when you're in the market for another flannel shirt, another pocket calculator. That Nature Valley granola bar you picked up on the mountain that day, maybe it made an impression. Maybe it didn't. Maybe you'd heard the name before, or maybe you hadn't. Maybe you'll buy another one someday if you're in the store and you recognize the package, but you'll be buying it because it fills a need. You'll be buying it because of the price, the look, the feel, the timing of the transaction. It shows up in the right place at the right time, so you take it home with you. And here, you would have gladly taken it home with you, even if you couldn't find the General Mills name on the package. A brand is a label on steroids. It might have started off as one of those nothing special names on the back of a flannel shirt, a distinctive green package on a granola bar you didn't even know you wanted, but it's become something else, something more. And usually, that's because the company behind the label has pumped a lot of advertising or promotional dollars into the product. It's got an identifiable logo, an identifiable style. This is where quality comes into the equation, because now you've been conditioned to expect a certain type of experience, and in this context, experience can also mean price. If it's a low-end brand, that's one type of experience. If you're at the high end, that's something else entirely. Either way, it's something you could count on. In our Nature Valley illustration, this is what happens when you've made enough trips to that same ski resort, when you've sampled enough of those granola bars to develop a taste for them, an appreciation for them, and you start to go looking for them in the store. Over time, the Nature Valley name has become a name you could trust for all your granola bar needs. You started to associate it with being active, being outdoors, paying attention to the food you put into your body, and once you start to think in this way, once you take yourself into a store with the express intent of purchasing a granola bar, you're more than likely to pick up the one you already know. The next step up from the brand stage is when you start to buy into a lifestyle. At this level, there's still the same promise of quality you've been conditioned to expect from a brand. Only more so. There's a predictable experience awaiting you. Only more so. But now that name has extended its reach into a number of products, goods, and services. Now it's like a seal of approval that cuts across a broad spectrum. Nike, Apple, Club Med, FUBU. It gets to where you're so comfortable with the quality and service of a company in one area that you seek out that same seal of approval in other areas. At General Mills, the Nature Valley brand became so successful that you can now find it on cereals, snack foods, nutrition bars. It's even become the official natural energy source of the U.S. ski and snowboard teams. Clearly, General Mills has built that initial ground-level push into something much, much bigger, something much, much broader. Over at FUBU, we went through these same stages, one by one, starting when I was slinging generic tie top hats and t-shirts from a duffel bag outside the New York Coliseum, to where we'd moved into dozens of different clothing lines, shoes, fragrances, and accessories. Folks came to know that they could hit us up at FUBU for almost anything they could wear or carry that would help them make a little noise when they walked into a club, when they hit the gym, when they sat down in a meeting, or walked down the corner to chill with friends. Along the way, we came up with our own viral marketing campaign back in those prehistoric days before social media. We didn't have an unlimited budget, or even a limited one. But we had an idea. We were just starting out, flush with a bunch of cash from our new partnership with Samsung, but the money was meant to cover production, not promotion. We had just enough in the budget to meet our first batch of orders. To do more than that, we were still on our own. Over time, our deal with Samsung was supposed to include marketing costs and help us ramp up our advertising efforts in a traditional way. But while we were waiting on that piece of that partnership to kick in, I hit on an idea for a guerrilla-type advertising campaign we can do on our own. Here's how it shook out. I got it in my head that we needed to do some billboard advertising. Only, billboard advertising in a city like New York can be one of the most expensive and least efficient ways to get the word out. You wind up paying ridiculous rates for eyeballs that don't necessarily have any interest in your product. so there was no way to justify the cost, even if we could afford it. Instead, I tried to think creatively. One night I was coming out of a meeting downtown, and I noticed a shop owner pulling down the security gate in front of his store. You've seen all these ugly, reinforced steel gates, right? You roll them down, and they cover the entire storefront. They're a part of the landscape in our big cities, and in Manhattan, they're usually covered in grime and graffiti. They can be a real eyesore. But one man's eyesore is another man's eye candy, right? So I had this thought. What if I could convince a bunch of store owners to let me pretty up those security gates for them? I could give the gates a good power wash, spray paint the FUBU logo on these clean canvases, done up in vibrant, attention-getting colors. It would be a way to get our name out there on the fly, on the down low, in full view of every pedestrian, every bus, every taxi that happened to pass by. Next morning, I started knocking on doors, making my pitch. And do you know what? Every single store owner I reached out to on this was happy to give me a shot. Why not? It didn't cost them anything. They could see I was passionate about what I was trying to do and would take the time to make sure my billboard looked good, which would, of course, make their storefront look good, too. And if they didn't like it, they could paint it over and start fresh. In just a couple weeks, I put together a network of 50 to 75 stores all over the city so that at 6, 7, 8 o'clock at night, as these stores started to close up for the evening, our billboards would be rolled down and we'd be on full display all night long until these stores opened up the next morning. It cost me about $200 to redo each gate, most of that going to the young graffiti artists I hired to do the makeover. They were happy for the gig. And no two gates looked alike. Some of them were real works of art. Yeah, it was a desperation move, but all these years later, I look back and realize it was a perfect example of the power of broke type strategies at the heart of this book. Matter of fact, it was so successful, we eventually moved the campaign all the way down to Philadelphia, where we were starting to make some noise. And here's the great kicker to this story. To this day, you can still see some of those FUBU logos every here and there. A little worse for wear, a little worn down by the elements, but a gritty reminder that there are ways to get the word out on the cheap. Flex those power of broke muscles. Sometimes, an entire industry is up against it, and these same power of broke principles kick in across the board. Just look at what happened to the tobacco industry. Some of you might be old enough to remember a time when cigarette ads ruled the airwaves. There were Joe Camel and Marlboro Man, and You've Come a Long Way, Baby, billboards all over. Across the street from schools, even. Television ads ran with the same frequency we see beer and car commercials today. But that all changed in the 1970s, and before the tobacco lobby caved to public sentiment, in an interesting sidebar-type story, American tobacco companies had one last chance to put the power of broke to work before the advertising restrictions kicked in. You see, around this time, the Chinese tobacco companies were looking to make a push into the U.S. market. This was a big deal, because the state-owned Chinese manufacturer alone already controlled about 30% of the world's cigarette sales. The last thing the American tobacco companies wanted was that kind of stiff competition here at home. Just look at how the Japanese electronics firms have effectively crushed their American competition outside of Apple. So what happened? Representatives of U.S. tobacco companies agreed not to fight government restrictions here because they effectively eliminated competition from abroad. Camel, Marlboro, Virginia Slims, they already had a chokehold on the market, so they got together and found a way to keep the market to themselves by agreeing to support a bill that would severely limit their advertising options. Understand, there was nothing preventing these Asian tobacco companies from selling their cigarettes in the United States, but without the ability to advertise on television, the move made no sense. Tough to make the case that these billion-dollar companies were broke, but they were definitely up against it, and here they had to find a way to scramble to hold on to their business. Think like your customer. One of the best ways I could think to illustrate how much more swiftly a lean, hungry, relatively broke company can respond to shifts in the marketplace more effectively than a well-financed corporate giant and market leader is to look at how the Girl Scouts of America have managed to compete with the big boys at, say, Nabisco, the division of Mondelez International that makes and markets the Oreo cookie. Thin Mints, Samoas, Tagalongs, they're a not-so-secret vice for a lot of us. But then, so are Oreos. Still, while Oreos are a $2 billion global brand, Girl Scout cookies pulls in more than a third of that, or $700 million in annual sales, based on an average of 200 million boxes sold each year at $3.50 a box. Think about that for a minute. It's amazing, really, that a sales force made up of little girls with a selling season that just lasts 6 to 12 weeks and a mission statement that says the organization's primary goal is to teach scouts about goal setting, money management, organizational skill, and decision-making strategies can even get close in revenues to the corporate giant. But they do, every year. In fact, in the first quarter of 2012, for the first time, the Thin Mint line actually passed the Oreo to become the number one selling cookie in the United States, with $200 million in sales. How do the Girl Scouts do it? Well, first of all, they have a great product, so that certainly helps. They've also got a great mission, and that helps too. Their customers feel a certain obligation to buy from the Girl Scouts because each sale comes with the promise that some of the proceeds will flow to the organization and to local scouting programs. That makes it a feel-good purchase, where a lot of folks, when they go in to buy a pack of Oreos, it becomes a feel-guilty purchase. All of these factors go into the plus column for the Girl Scouts and help to erase the clear advantage enjoyed by the Nabisco folks in terms of advertising dollars and brand recognition. Here's another edge. Because Girl Scout cookies are only sold at certain times during the year, the American public has become conditioned to jump on them when they're available. The seasonal selling cycle creates a sense of urgency among customers, setting it up so that folks start to think they better get them while they can. So yeah, there are all these contributing factors that help the Girl Scouts move a whole bunch of cookies. But I have to believe that the organization's biggest asset is the passion and commitment of its sales force. Think about it. These girls become eligible for all kinds of prizes and scholarships if they manage to outsell their friends. You've got situations where an entire troop is out there trying to ring up the most sales in the country. An incentive-laden selling program like that is a powerful motivational tool. It encourages these kids to think outside the cookie box and set up shop in places where they can maximize their limited selling window. In one famous story, a Girl Scout in San Francisco sold 117 boxes of cookies in just 2 hours outside a medical marijuana clinic, where someone must have told her she'd find a bunch of folks with the munchies. Easy marks for her not-so-hard sell. In another move that got a lot of media attention, a girl in New York set up a table on the corner of Park Avenue and 51st Street, right outside the headquarter offices of some of the biggest financial institutions in the city, including J.P. Morgan Chase, UBS, and the Blackstone Group. She sold through her entire inventory of 240 boxes in less than an hour. Can't imagine that a big company like Nabisco, with its corporate infrastructure and ingrained selling strategies, would have ever been nimble enough to sell in such a targeted way. But this is just one example of how you can remain competitive without a big budget. Hear what your customer hears. The Girl Scouts aren't the only ones thinking like their customers. One of the best examples of this type of approach came from the King of Pop, Michael Jackson. It came to me through my friend Hype Williams, one of the most successful music video directors on the planet. He told me a story one day that really struck me and stayed with me. He was working with Michael Jackson at the height of Michael's fame, and one day, the King of Pop, at this point one of the most famous and successful musicians in the business, showed up on the set with a dinky little transistor radio. Hype took one look at Michael, listening to his song through his tiny little radio with a tiny little sound, and Hype wondered what was up. So he asked Michael. Michael's explanation hit home. He said, "Hype, most of the people listening to my music will be listening through a radio just like this one. I want to hear what they hear." This was Michael Jackson's thinking. and he had everybody working with him keep this in mind. I found this fascinating because I was close to the music industry, and all I knew of the business was that music always sounded great in a high-end studio. I don't care if you're recording a version of Old MacDonald Had a Farm. If you dress it up the right way, with state-of-the-art sound and production, it can blow you away.